The Second Testament reading is from Mark chapter 2, verses 13 to 17. It can be found on page 37 of your pew Bible. Jesus went out again beside the sea. The whole crowd gathered around him, and he taught them. As he was walking along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. And as he sat at dinner in Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were also sitting with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" When Jesus heard this, he said to them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
The Lord be with you. Some weeks ago in December, I got to preach about the story from the book of Daniel. It was during the time of the Babylonian captivity. It was a story about a king's dream. It was a dream that turned into a nightmare of God's judgment. The arrogant king Nebuchadnezzar was driven away from human society. He was forced to live like a beast. He was feeding on grass like an ox. He was bathed in the dew of heaven each day. In the fields and the wide spaces of creation, his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails became like bird's claws. But it turned out that that judgment became a sort of a blessing. It was a time of deep clarity. It was renewal, and the king, who had exalted himself above everyone else, became a creature once again. He met his maker and was given another chance. God's grace was revealed to the bad guy in this story. In time, the exile in Babylon came to an end. There was a new regime this time. This time they were Persians. The king was named Cyrus the Great. And he earned the great, too. He was a statesman, a humanitarian. He was respected and honored. And he respected and cared for the people that he conquered, their beliefs, their religion. In that same spirit, he allowed the Hebrew people to go home. They went home to rebuild. The long, long task of restoring some of their past glory. Home after all of these long years of exile. And they had their work cut out for them. Politically, the Hebrews had been split for generations, the northern and the southern kingdoms. There were old tensions, resentments that continued year after year. And theologically, there were new and opposing expressions of Judaism springing up, each with their own view of purity, of cultural engagement, philosophical point of view. To complicate things further, while a portion of the Hebrew people had been held captive in Babylon, another group of people had been left behind. People who just weren't suitable hostage material. They were simple peasants and rural folk, agrarian people that worked the earth. And in that same time of exile, they had endured their own share of hardship. They were occupying prime real estate in the Fertile Crescent, and they had weathered invasions from raiders, from Egypt, Hittites and Assyrians. And somehow they survived, but not without some compromises and some trade-offs along the way. For one, these people often adopted the more primitive theological practices that looked a lot more like pagan fertility cults. And they tended to intermarry and sort of integrate with the local population. If we read the book of Nehemiah and Ezra, which come together and tell the story of the return from exile, Ezra chapter 10 says to us, "Then Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, 'You have trespassed and married foreign women, and so increased the guilt of Israel. Now make confession to the Lord, the God of your ancestors, and do his will. Separate yourselves from the people of the land and from the foreign wives. This is a call to racial purity, practice of separation and religious observance with rules and regulations, people of pedigree, piety and holiness, and living biblically, strictness, vigilance in the face of compromise and sin, and a rejection of the people of the land. Over time, that phrase, people of the land, would become synonymous with the common folk who didn't follow holy codes. Lost cause sinners, lowlifes, disreputable people who had been best if we ostracized and avoided them. People you could really look down your nose at. Uncouth peasants. Different times in history, we might have called them hillbillies, or Celts, or barbarians. I might ask, do we have any equivalent people groups in Canada like that today? People with suspect genetics, coarser language or way of life, different traditions, unsophisticated religious practices, the butt of too many jokes. We continue the story today in Mark's gospel, in the time and the place where Jesus lived, some 400 years after. And many of these same tensions were still at play. Galilee, the place where Jesus spent so much time, literally means the district of the nations. It was a diverse melting pot with people from all over. Blue-collar people of trade and commerce, rough around the edges sort of people. Another imperial regime had come and gone. This time it was the Romans. In the midst of it all, the Hebrew people were as divided as ever. Competing religious groups claimed authority. Wandering rabbis and teachers gathered followers. Political factions struggled to remain relevant. Violence and racial tensions continued. And through it all, one group would accuse the other of collaborating with the enemy, and the other group would accuse the other of failing to live as God's true people. Religious officials and opportunists, political rivals, and rich urban elites would jockey for power. And all the while, there remained this continued culture of contempt and disdain for that national embarrassment known as the people of the land. But by this time, that term had an even broader stretch. It was a term for no good sinners and untouchables and outcasts. And the truth is, for these plain folk, times were tough. As an occupied people, they were heavily taxed by Rome. And to make matters worse, there were two more layers of local government that took most of what was left. If you didn't have connections, or if you just came from the wrong part of town, you did whatever you could to survive. You worked with your hands, you tended animals, you fished, you labored in a rich man's field. If you read the Gospels, Jesus' stories and parables are filled with these sorts of people. People who ate rough cakes of barley. They smelt like sweat. They had pains in their backs. They had calluses on their hands. They had sore feet, low wages, and few prospects. One of my favorite songs of all time is by Tennessee Ernie Ford. I'm not going to sing it, but I'll give you some lyrics. I don't have the baritone like he does. Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's a weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. Whew. Amongst the other career options, there was another way, though. This one could stand to make you some real money. Serious coin, even, if you played your cards right. All you had to do is check your conscience at the door, make all the right connections with either the Romans or the Herodians, and you could bid on a contract to levy taxes. You could be a middleman, and you could tax food and fish and commerce, or tolls and roads and bridges. And to be clear, this was not a job for the civil servants in a liberal democracy like Canada. So if you work for tax, the tax officials, we're not talking about you. This is a job for a collaborator with the brutal regime. Someone who made themselves rich, skimming extra profits for themselves. An embezzler, a con artist, an amoral, complete failure. A spiritually compromised, a race traitor, an unholy person. If the people of the land were undesirable, then these sellout tax farmers were outcasts on a whole another level. Whenever someone wanted to make a list in the ancient world of some really awful, terrible people, you'd be sure to find those tax gatherers on the list. I was trying to think of what it could be like for a guy like me to pay taxes to someone like that. Is it paying a parking ticket? A speeding ticket? The story that came to mind for me is when Simon, sitting up in the balcony, hey Simon, I got permission to tell this story. He's one of our first kids and a faithful youth leader, so be sure and say hi to him later. But he asked me to tag along when we were going to go look at some really cheap cars. And I'm not an expert, but at least I thought I could be a second set of eyes and I could maybe stop him from buying something if it was too terrible, which maybe I did. I don't know. But we ended up in some parts of Edmonton after our Kijiji search that had a very uniquely disheveled nature to them. We were looking for something cheap, and we'd looked for a few different specimens, and with each test drive, let's just say that these proposed transactions did not fill our hearts with warmth and trust and security. And the kicker for me was when one of the would-be sellers convinced Simon to do a test drive around the block, and the vehicle wouldn't work unless there was one of those portable booster attachment kits attached to it. And so with the hood still up, I watched this car with dead springs lurching around the corner. It was barely drivable, chugging and sputtering and lurching. And despite the many troubles and obvious liabilities of the vehicle, I was amazed at just how sure of themselves these sellers were. How hopeful they were that they could cash in on our haste or our desperation. Afterwards, we did have a good laugh about it. And eventually, Troy, my brother-in-law, set Simon up with a pretty great used car. But if, like a lot of people, I didn't have a choice, if I was desperate, if I was alone, if I didn't have someone to look out for me, I would be at the mercy of someone who I couldn't trust, maybe. I'd probably develop long-standing resentment and anger towards those sorts of people, especially if it happened to me every day. Do we have a 21st century equivalent of a first century Galilean tax farmer? Is it a payday loan operator? A human trafficker? A pimp? A drug dealer? Unscrupulous people who find a creepy, an unethical niche to exploit the poor and the powerless. They're always there somewhere. I'm not sure what comes to mind for you, but in this story in Mark's gospel, we find out that this is the sort of person who Jesus calls. This is the sort of powerful and prophetic action where Jesus shows us what following him looks like, what his ministry is shaped like. And it's amazing how Mark can do so much with so little space. Our story today happens in 139 words. Hyper-condensed little stories that speak hope and freedom and possibility to the troubled people in a world of division, scars, and greed. The text says, as Jesus was walking along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, follow me. and he got up and followed him. Now, we don't know what kind of choices brought Levi to the job at the tax booth, but we might guess. But here in this story, we find out that it only takes two words from Jesus to reach across the gulf of culture and history and shame and religion. Follow me. Got past all of it, past a man's loneliness, past all of his regrets, past his broken heart. A man full of remorse for what he had done and what he had left undone. Levi abandoned all that dirty money in a flash, all of that so-called financial security. And he left behind the tax booth that had become a prison. This isn't just a story of Jesus calling a disciple. This is a healing story. Like the story of a king who gets a fresh start. This is a liberation story about a man made new, a lost man found, a slave set free. A man who knew what all of that money was really worth in the end. Someone who jumped at the first chance to do something of real value. Someone who grabbed a hold of a fresh start right there on the lakeside. The corrupted man who had isolated himself from his land, his people, his faith, and his God, in two words, became a follower of Jesus, the rabbi and the healer. I can't help but think how awkward it would have been for Levi in his fancy clothes to join the ranks of the disciple fishermen, Simon, Andrew, James, and John, those rough working men who probably many times had to fork over their taxes to him. Even more awkward if he taxed the fish industry, maybe. Sometimes this stuff is awkward, friends. But I assure you, it is quite worth it. In the next scene, we're back at Levi's house. And it's a party, see? It's a day of celebration. And Levi invites all of his friends. And why not? Should Levi only invite respectable people? Well, the first answer is, how could he? He doesn't know any respectable people. But I can hear him say, if Jesus invites the likes of me, then there might be hope for all of my scoundrel friends. Hope for all sorts of alienated and isolated and desperate people who feel like they're out of choices. People who gather around a table with the Lord, where the Savior breaks bread with the lowlifes. We catch the first glimpses of the shape and trajectory of the life of Jesus in his ministry. A table set for sinners, a meal shared with the Son of Man. It's this table of celebration that anticipated the table where the church gathers in Jesus' name. It's still a community of damaged people made new. And it's still a wide and broad invitation. The church is at its sickest and its worst when it's a society of religious experts and insiders. It's at its sickest and its worst when it's a place for holy people to congratulate one another. No, the church follows Jesus when it is a place of grace and peace, scooped up in huge celebratory bowls full, the holy meal of Jesus' hospitality, sometimes taken potluck in the church basement, sometimes taken on little plates and cups from the platform in the church sanctuary. It's a table where people with humiliating stories and poor life choices find new life, a place of healing and unexpected invitation, a wide invitation to an endless assortment of people of the land, many of whom are as surprised to be there as you are. Friends, this isn't our call story. This is our healing story. Thanks be to God.